glad to have you back. Mel's been a regular here for, 20-some-odd years, so.
Yeah,
it's been great. So, and just hearing you say that reminded me of the time that I, too, had open-heart surgery. Wasn't because of any kind of problem with my arteries. I had a clot from taking a flight to Australia. And so when you're sitting on a plane that long in economy, things can happen. So they thought it was cholesterol. Turned out just to be a clot. So I actually have 5 arteries feeding my heart now instead of just 4. But the greatest blessing of all, I was in the hospital for 4 days, and I had 5 chaplains visit me. And I was told that nobody gets more than 1 chaplain visit, but I got 5. And the first 4 of the 5 were chaplains that didn't believe the Bible was the Word of God, and it was clear that they did not have a relationship with Jesus Christ. So I asked them why, and they said, science. Science is the reason why I reject it. So, in each case, I had about an hour-long conversation with the chaplain, and it was wonderful. I was in a ward where I had an audience, and nurses actually came in to listen to the dialogue going on. So, sometimes God takes you through things in order to help other people out. So, I'm sure that's happened to you too, Mel. Been great. Well, what we've been doing these past few weeks, for those of you that are guests, and I can see there are a lot of guests here, is that we've been looking at Earth's history and recognizing that we human beings are here at a unique time. I mean, we live on a planet that's 4.5662 billion years old. That's only accurate to 5 places the decimal now. But only in the last 2.58 million years have we had an ice age cycle. We've had ice ages before, but the ice ages that have existed in the past of Earth's history have lasted millions of years. What we have in the past 2.58 million years are ice ages that last only a few tens of thousands of years, where you've got a warm interglacial between them. And for the first couple of million years of that ice age cycle, the ice age cycle was 41,000 years, which means the warm interglacials were only about 2,000 or 3,000 years wide, not wide enough to have a large human population or any kind of civilization. But as the ice age cycle progressed, we transitioned from a 41,000 year cycle to a 100,000 year cycle. That's been the case for the last 800,000 years. 100,000 year ice age cycle. But as we go from the beginning of this 100,000 year ice age cycle to the present, each ice age has become more severe than the previous one. As we've been discussing in the class, it's all because of what's happening with India. The Indian subcontinent broke off from Madagascar about 50 million years ago, charged at a high velocity towards Asia, high velocity, 20 centimeters per year. But that's the highest tectonic velocity that's ever been measured. And it crashed into Asia starting about 20 million years ago. And that's why we have the Himalayas. The Himalayas are basically the crumpled up seafloor of the collision between India and Asia. And the collision is still ongoing. India is still moving north and west into Asia. And so the Himalayas are getting taller and taller every year. The Tibetan Plateau is being pushed up higher and higher. And during each ice age, the Tibetan Plateau becomes covered with ice. And even today, in a warm interglacial, the third largest store of ice is in the Himalayas and Tibet. Now, because it's close to the equator, when it becomes covered with ice, it really cools the planet. In fact, its cooling effect per square kilometer is 4 times greater than what you see in Greenland or Antarctica. And that's because the sunlight rays are hitting it directly as opposed to an angle with respect to Greenland and Antarctica. And the Tibetan Plateau is continuing to be pushed up as a result of India crashing into Asia, which explains why for the last 8 ice ages, each successive ice age has become more severe. Now, I won't go into the details, but it's because we're in a warm interglacial following the most severe ice age in the ice age cycle, that we can have 7 billion people living on the planet today. Just because of the water flow, the nutrient transport, we have these huge plains, well enriched with nutrients, well watered as a result of the flow from the last ice age, so it's actually possible to grow food enough to sustain 7 billion people. And also because of the severity of the last ice age, it has exposed minerals that we're able to mine, which explains why metallurgy was so quickly developed by humans following the last ice age. And here's a scriptural context for this. In terms, and what have we been saying here in the classes, if you go through all the creation texts in the Bible, all the major creation texts make the point that God's works of redemption precede his works of creation. So everything he creates is in the context of bringing redemption to a large number of people. And this passage in Revelation 7 tells us that God's intent in creating, his intent was that a large number of human beings would receive his offer of redemption and enter into the new creation with him. There before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and in front of the Lamb. They were wearing white robes. And so the fact that they're wearing white robes tells us they're part of the redeemed. And when it says every nation, tribe, people, language, it's basically saying there isn't a single people group that's going to be left out from this host of the redeemed. And when it says a great multitude that no one could count, we discussed this last week. At the time this was written in the first century, the Greek and Roman culture had a counting system that would go up into the high hundreds of millions. And therefore we're talking at a minimum billions of people being in front of the throne of God for every nation, tribe, people, and language. Which means we need a planet that's capable of sustaining billions of people. Because after all, the biblical texts are clear that whereas a large number will be redeemed, it will not be a majority. In fact, if you go into Zechariah 13, it gives you the actual figure for the percentage of Jews, for example, that will receive God's redemptive offer. And it says it's 1/3. Now, I believe that number would apply roughly to the Gentiles as well. But that means that the host of people living on the planet would have to be into the billions. So I think 7 billion people living on the face of the earth is quite consistent with this text. And this is the only time in the history of planet Earth where a planet could actually sustain 7 billion people at one time. Or to put it in another context, the number of people over the age of 65 that are alive today make up a majority of all people who've ever lived who've made it past age 65. Yes?
Some people might say, well, look at all the tons of land, even locally, that are not currently inhabited, per se, you know, when drive to Vegas,
sure,
so on and so on and so on. But from what I gather from what you're saying, it's not necessarily just a space of spatial land that could accommodate larger population. You're talking about a planet's resource that could accommodate, correct?
Correct. Well, okay. In order for this innumerable host to be redeemed, you need a large population. You're also going to need technology. So the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ can literally be taken to every tribe, nation, language, and people. And so this requires a planet that's able to sustain billions of people at one time, but to sustain them at a reasonable technology level to facilitate what we see at the end of the book of Matthew, where Jesus says to his disciples, I want you to take the good news to Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. And what I'm going to do is actually take you through the Bible and show you how the increasing human population and increasing technology fits into this very text. Now, we live in a warm interglacial, but that warm interglacial must come to an end, a relatively soon end. So there's a time constraint here too. Now, you are onto something. Our planet has the potential to sustain more than 7 billion people. but not a whole lot more than 7 billion people. So I'm very comfortable with the idea that our population might rise to 10 billion. Because you're right. I mean, we could use our technology to take the melting water from the glaciers and ice fields of the last ice age that are still present here in North America, basically what you see in Canada, and transport that water into the thirsty western, southwestern part of the U.S. and Mexico and grow more food. That could be done. Yes?
How many people have existed since the garden?
Okay, good question. If we go all the way back to Adam and Eve, how many human beings have ever lived here on planet Earth? And this is a problem that's still being wrestled with. The low figure I've heard is 40 billion. There's been a minimum of 40 billion people have ever lived on the face of the Earth. The upper range is around 90 billion that have ever lived on the face of the Earth. So somewhere between 40 and 90 billion. I've seen some estimates that take it up even as high as 100 billion. The one that takes it as high as 100 billion, though, has to infuse a lot more death into the early history of humanity. In other words, lots of people being born, thrown into battle, being killed off. And you certainly see some of that in the early chapters of the Bible, that was going on. But to get up as high as 100 billion, it's got to be so extreme that I don't know, there's some challenges with that. And also, one thing that limits that is, if you're going to have a high, early population of humanity, then you're going to have discoverable remains. But discoverable remains are rather scant once you get earlier than, say, 15,000 years. Over here.
Yes, I don't know if I missed this, but what about when Christ said that the road is narrow? And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, the road is narrow, but which tells us that, in fact, Jesus was explicit that it would never be a majority that would receive redemption. But what I'm going to be showing as we go through the Bible is that it's not going to be a small minority. In other words, it's not going to be just 1%. It's going to be a significant minority. And we actually have that minority defined for the Jewish people group in Zechariah 13, where it says one third will recognize the one whom they have pierced. And so, and tells us in Galatians that God treats Jews and Gentiles on a par. So I think we can extrapolate from Zechariah 13 that we're talking Gentiles is probably going to be in the same neighborhood. Now, when I say same neighborhood, I'd be comfortable with anything between 25 and 40%. So somewhere in that range. So we shouldn't be satisfied with, say, 2 or 3%. And by the way, I'm going to show you some statistics which tells us we're already way beyond 2 or 3%. We're way beyond 10%. So, but we're going to get to that. Okay. There before me was this great multitude. Now, let me move on. And this is the most recent ice age cycle, and what you see here is that when we're during an ice age, and this is true of all the ice ages for the past 2.58 million years, you get extreme climate instability when there's ice over Canada and Siberia and other parts of the planet. And when you get into a warm interglacial, this is the last warm interglacial, you likewise get this extreme climate instability. So for 2.58 million years, we've had this ice age cycle, which is crucial in order to have a large human population and technology, but only in this warm interglacial have we had climate stability. Every other warm interglacial, the temperature has rapidly spiked to a maximum and rapidly collapsed back down into an ice age. This is the only one where we see what scientists refer to as the long cool summer or the long warm spring. We call it that because it's not at the maximum. We're about 3 to 4 degrees centigrade below the maximum that we've seen in other warm interglacials. But it's literally been stable for the last 9,000 years. Now, this is showing you the temperature record in Greenland and Antarctica. But just 2 weeks ago. In fact, I got the paper here, if you're interested. They've done a study out of the Alps showing that you get the same pattern of extreme climate instability during the Ice Age, and for the last 9,000 years, it's been stable. And it's actually been a report making the thing that what we see in Greenland and what we see in Antarctica is actually representative of the entire planet, and certainly what we're experiencing now. Now, it takes this climate stability in order to establish large-scale agriculture and metallurgy. And this is what we see. There are biblical texts, particularly Genesis 2 and Genesis 11, that tell us that both Adam and Eve and Noah lived during the last ice age. And so during that time, you did have human beings engaging in some level of civilization, but it was local and it was family-oriented. You look at the book of Job, for example. What you see are a few small city-states, but no nations. You don't see a priestly system of worship. And so it indicates that you're in a period where we do not yet have large-scale organized civilization. And so we go from... The beginning of this climate stability starts 9,000 years ago. The Neolithic Revolution begins 11,000 to 12,000 years ago. Yes?
There's a spot from there, both in Greenland and in Antarctica, where it's a little more stable, around 100,000.
You mean like right here?
No, a little further. Well, actually there, but a little further. It's kind of stable for a while. It goes significantly down, but it's not so erratic.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, what you'll see is maybe they'll, like here you see what looks like a period of stability. It doesn't last very long, but it only shows up on one of the four.
Oh.
And it doesn't show up on the Alps one either. So, I mean, in terms of globally distributed climate stability, we're basically in the only era where it's happened. In fact, in terms of having an optimal, stable climate stability and temperature, this is the only time in the entire history of the Earth we've had that. So, and there's reasons for that. I won't go into that. But the whole point is, we have Adam and Eve being created somewhere during this last ice age. Noah comes later. And then you have the Neolithic Revolution. The Neolithic Revolution is the when you first see people specializing. And so 11,000 years ago is where they discover towns in the northwest part of the Mesopotamian plain where you've got people growing raising goats, and that's all they do. They simply raise goats. They're raising thousands of goats, and that's their livelihood. And what the goat raisers do is they have this specialization of agriculture, and they trade with people who specialize in wheat. So about 11,000 years ago in northwest Mesopotamia, we see a simultaneous launching of villages and towns where one village will do nothing but raise goats, another village will focus on raising wheat, another village will focus on pottery, and another village will focus on building transportation systems, and basically they trade with one another. So it's the first time you actually see large-scale manufacturing or agricultural activity and trading, and this is what enables the population to begin to increase. You cannot have increasing population unless you have a surplus of food. It's a surplus of food that transitioned people from basically a hunter-gatherer type existence, or where a family, for example, will have a farm where they do everything. You know, they refer to it as mixed farming. People have hobby farms. And what that is you've got a few acres where you got some goats, you got some horses, you got some cows, you raise corn, you raise wheat, you kind of do everything. But it will not allow the population to increase. It basically sustains your family. Yes?
When are you saying the book of Job? Well, two questions. When was the book of Job written? And what is the time era that Job lived in?
Okay. Most scholars believe that the content of the book of Job and the story, the life of Job, happens somewhere in the Abrahamic era or a little bit earlier. So we're talking about 500, 600, 700, some people say 800 years before Moses. Okay, and clearly it's before Moses because you don't see a priestly system of worship and you don't see nations. And so there's really no reference to the kind of politics that you see in the Mosaic text.
You had Egypt as an empire at that
time. The Egyptian empire didn't peak until the time of Moses. And it didn't become dominant as a world empire until the time of Moses, yes.
What would be the advantage of creating human beings when the same temperature is rather assumed in that time, obviously?
Okay, interesting question. Why didn't God create Adam and Eve here instead of way back here? Well, I think this is a time when you had long lifespans, and during this era, long lifespans were not possible. What happened during this era was that you had a nearby supernova eruption. In fact, come around February, you'll be able to look out at the constellation Monoceros, and in that constellation is a supernova remnant that's 25 degrees across in the sky. It was only discovered a little while ago because it's so close that we're actually it's so diffuse that it's hard to see the boundaries. But we now know that about 95% of the killer cosmic rays come from that single event. And we know that supernova erupted somewhere during this last ice age. So before the eruption, people could live a long time. After the eruption, they could not. And why did God want people living a long time? And why did he want a flood? Well, I think there's an object lesson there. I mean, Jeremiah 17. Why do we rebel against our Creator? It's not because of our external circumstances, not because we don't live long enough. It says it's because of our heart. But we have a hard time believing that. We like to blame everything else. It's my parents. It's my lousy job. Or it's the government. If only my party was in power, things wouldn't be like this. Or it's my health. And you know, people have all kinds of excuses. Satan made me do it. So what we see in Scripture is that God performs these humanity-wide object lessons. You think living a long time is going to be a really great salvation for you? I'm going to let you live for 800 or 900 years, and we saw the consequences of that. Or during the millennium. I'm premillennial in my theology. I believe the Lord will return and will establish a 1,000-year reign here on earth. And that, by the way, colors what I'm going to be saying today, because I believe that this period of stability can't be sustained for much longer than 1,000 years. And if we're going to have Christ reigning on the planet for 1,000 years, that means we're going to be filling the Great Commission relatively quickly, just based on what we know about what's possible for sustaining this period of stability. But there again, what you see in the millennial text is that God takes away every human excuse for why we sin. You think that Satan's the problem? I'm going to lock the guy up for 1,000 years. So you can't blame Satan. You can't blame the government. Jesus Christ himself will be in charge of the government. The children born are going to be born to people who are believers. So, I mean, literally every excuse is, and by the way, those believers are morally perfected, having been raised from the dead and brought back to earth. So all excuses are taken away. But what does God do at the end of the millennium? He releases Satan from his prison to test the children who were born during the millennium. Why the test? Because nobody gets to go to the new creation without being tested by the greatest challenge that evil can possibly throw at you. Why? Because God wants us to enter the new creation eternally secure in a relationship with him. And so he takes us through the most difficult tests. He helps us pass the most difficult tests, and nothing more challenging can ever threaten you ever again.
Hugh?
Yes?
Is there a timeline on when the Great Commission will be fulfilled?
Well, let me jump into that because we've been trying to get to that every week, and we've always been having to deal with other issues. But you had a question,
yeah,
Ross.
You say that the next ice age is going to come within 1,000 years. You think?
Well, 1,000, 1,500, but not much longer. And some people think we're only looking at hundreds of years.
So how does that affect our current conception of global warming? How do you think all that fits together?
Well, global warming could actually hasten the onset of the next ice age, because global warming could actually wind up melting the entire polar ice cap. And as it is, in my lifetime alone, half of the polar ice cap is gone. It's such that now the Northwest Passage is open to shipping. But if you melt all of the polar ice cap due to global warming, then you've got sunlight pouring upon those Arctic waters, evaporating that water, which could allow more snow to fall over Siberia and Canada and initiate an ice age. That's one model. There are other explanations, but what we do notice in these, you know, I could show you actually the last eight ice ages, and what you notice is every time the temperature warms by 3 or 4 degrees centigrade beyond where it is right now, we rapidly drop into an ice age. So something from that warming stimulates the onset of an ice age, and you know, one of the more popular theories is that global warming could actually melt the polar ice cap and cause more precipitation over Canada and Siberia. It's plenty cold enough in Canada to bring about an ice age today. The only reason why we don't have an ice age, you don't get enough snowfall over those regions. Believe me, I've been there. It gets plenty cold in the wintertime. The telescope I used to use in northern Canada, we would have, well, we had snow 11 out of the 12 months of the year. We had four seasons. We had 2 weeks of black flies, we had 2 weeks of mosquitoes, 2 weeks of deer flies, and 10.5 months of winter. And I loved the winter because it would get down to 50 below, and that would take all the water out of the atmosphere, and the quality of my observations were actually 400% better than they were in the summertime. So I thank God for those cold Canadian climes. But what stops it from being covered with ice is the precipitation level is less than 10 inches equivalent per year. And so snow falls there, but not enough that it accumulates. Double that, and you get an ice sheet thousands of feet thick. And that's what happened during the last ice age. So yeah, I mean, because of what's happening in the orbit of the Earth, we're heading to a cooling event no matter what we do. So all of our efforts to try to maintain climate stability inevitably will come to an end. But hey, if you're an optimist, we might be able to put it off for maybe 1,100, 1,200 years. But after that, we're going to be going back into there. And once we get back into this, large-scale agriculture is over. You cannot have, you know, hundreds of square miles of specialized agriculture if the climate is changing rapidly over a period of time. In fact, a paper was published a few months ago making the claim that it's impossible to sustain any kind of organized large-scale agriculture unless you've got extreme climate stability. That's what it takes for us to be able to sustain these billions of people upon the face of the earth. Okay, so let's kind of dig into the text here a little bit. We have this Neolithic Revolution starting 11,000 years ago, but the Neolithic Revolution takes place right about here. The temperature is going up, and it's not very stable, but it is stable enough. And by the way, having the temperature getting warmer and warmer and not having episodes where it gets colder and colder actually allows you to have a limited degree of agricultural specialization. It's the sudden drops in the cold that really knock it out. And so during this particular phase here, the temperature basically is rising upwards. And so, hey, if it gets a little bit warmer, you can actually change your crops a little bit. It's the up and down that's a real problem. So this explains why we could have a Neolithic Revolution beginning about here. When we're talking about a Neolithic Revolution, we're talking about villages, for example, having thousands of goats. Not millions of goats, but thousands of goats. And you kind of see that in the book of Job, because there's actually an inventory there on the animals that Job owned. And he talks about the, you know, how many camels he had, how many sheep he had, and cows and goats, and it was in the thousands in each case, but not the millions. And if we're talking the climate gradually warming, that is possible. and then we enter a period where we actually have stability. When you got stability, it's actually possible for people to grow such a great surplus of food, they can settle down and specialize. Even specialize to a point where all they do is philosophy. And you kind of see that. I mean, Eliphaz, for example, came from a town of philosophers. Teman was a town where all the population basically got together and thought all day. Now, that's not possible unless you've got a great surplus of food and you've got, you know, metallurgy going on and you've got a fair amount of trade taking place. So it's actually possible with the wealth that you have to set aside a small segment of that population where all they do is think all day. So, and, you know, people actually say it, that's a worthwhile activity. And so, you know, Eliphaz is a good example of that. The wisest man from a town filled with people that all they did was think about philosophy all day long. And they shipped off their greatest of their philosophers to talk to Job and to comfort Job. And, well, anyway, I won't go into the rest of it, but you can read the book of Job and see how that went. But that tells us that the context of the book of Job is not during this period, but had to be during this time of great stability, where he actually had the luxury of having an entire town and all of its citizens devoted to the activity of philosophy. And so now that means that we have to have not only large-scale agriculture going on, but large-scale manufacture going on, and a trading system and a transportation system where people could actually efficiently trade their goods. And so, but if you look at the book of Job, you basically have these small city-states, you don't have nations. And so I believe that Abraham shows up slightly after the time scale of Job. And what does God do with Abraham? He says, leave your place in Samaria. I want you to go to the land of Canaan. Now, here's the political and geographical context that's going on here. This is the first time in the history of humanity where you've got nations, not just small city-states, but nations, and where the nations are trading with one another, and where the nations actually have significant populations. And so what God says to Abraham, I want you to go to Canaan. Now, by going to Canaan, he's in the nexus of the emerging nation states. You've got Egypt starting to develop. You've got Assyria. You've got Babylon starting to develop. There's a civilization we now refer to as Turkey. They were developing. And he basically put Abraham in the middle of all that. Why? So that as these nations would communicate with one another and trade with one another, they would come into contact with Abraham and his descendants. And God was basically putting Abraham in a particular locale where he could be used to take God's message to these first emerging nations. And so this kind of explains what we see there in Genesis chapter 12, God uprooting this one man and his family and saying, go here, and I'm giving you a mission. So this is Abraham. Yes.
How did the Chinese cultural development fit into this timeline of the other developing nations?
Well, you have nations elsewhere emerging a little bit later. Now, keep in mind, I've been to Asia, and the Japanese and the Koreans and the Chinese all claim that their civilization goes back like 10,000 years. What we can't demonstrate is that they had the level of civilization and population and trading capability that we saw, say, with the Mesopotamians and the Egyptians living about 4,000 years ago. And this is something that historians have noted, is that the records that go back that far, you tend to see a lot of exaggeration. And by the way, that was also true of the Babylonians and the Egyptians. They all exaggerated their history. You see this in particular with the Akkadians and the Sumerians when they talk about how long their first line of kings lived. They claim they lived about 10,000 years apiece. Now, they probably were living like what we see in the early chapters of Genesis, 800 or 900 years, but they exaggerated it by about a factor of 10. And by the way, that seems to be typical of these oral records that come from around Europe and Asia. You see it in Africa as well. It's curious that there seems to be consistently this roughly factor of a 10 exaggeration. By the way, that shows all the way up into Homer's writings. You know, Homer talks about these battles that took place, and the Battle of Marathon. Historians now take Homer's figures and divide by 10. So what he recorded was accurate. The numbers he put in were not accurate. And also what's interesting is that when you go into these ancient Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Egyptian, Babylonian records, they edit out all the bad stuff. And so, for example, what you'll see in the Egyptian records, they edit out the 10 plagues. That was bad stuff. We're not going to record that. Or where they get defeated in battle, that gets omitted from the record. All the victories are there, but the defeats are not. And this is kind of what set the Hebrews apart, because the Hebrews would record the bad stuff and the good stuff, the defeats and the victories. It wasn't edited, and they basically showed their leaders as real people with virtues and faults combined. Whereas when you read these ancient records of other cultures, their kings seem to have remarkable virtue with no moral faults whatsoever. And so, again, this is kind of part of where I'm going here, is that the peoples of the world saw the message coming from the Hebrews as a real, true message, not distorted like what they're getting there. And that actually played into the Hebrews being able to take the good news to all the people groups of the world. Okay, so that kind of brings us up to Abraham. And then we notice, here's Abraham in the land of Canaan. Now what's happening historically is you're seeing a decline in the Mesopotamian culture, the Hittite culture, but the rise of the Egyptian Empire. And the Egyptian Empire rises to a point where they begin to dominate the Mesopotamian nations and the Hittite nations. They were the first world empire. And so when they rise to the first world empire, what does God do? He sends a Jew to Egypt as a slave. The story of Joseph. The timing of Joseph is he was not sold into slavery by his brothers into Egypt until Egypt became a world empire, the first world empire on planet Earth. So the moment Egypt rose to become the first world empire, God sends a Jew from the land of Canaan into Egypt itself and sends him as a slave. And I think most of you know the story. By the way, I don't know why Hollywood isn't making a movie about Joseph. It's one of the greatest stories.
Make one.
Yeah, many decades ago they made one. I think it's time for them. And now, the one I loved they made decades ago, it was biblically accurate. I mean, how can you improve upon the drama of the story of Joseph? It's a remarkably dramatic story. And so Joseph is sent into Egypt, and here he is a slave. And what happens to him as a slave? A lot of bad things happen to him. But in the course of all those bad things, he rises to become the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire. And so he literally is elevated to a point of enormous influence. And through his influence and through the emigration of all of his relatives into the best part of Egypt. And by the way, the land of Goshen is strategic, and that Goshen is a place where it's make it very, because that's where all the transportation systems went through. That was kind of the agricultural core of the Egyptian Empire, and really gave the Jews the capacity to communicate the message of salvation to all the peoples in the Egyptian Empire. And what you see recorded in the book of Exodus is the influence that these Jewish slaves had on the people around them. Testimony to that influence is the huge population that left in the Exodus. I've not seen the new movie in the Exodus, but I'm betting they didn't really portray just how many Egyptians joined in with the Jews in the Exodus. And we know that the people from the Egyptian Empire, the non-Jews, had to be the dominant part of the population that left Egypt. because the biblical text records that we're looking at about 3.5 million human beings minimum. Just based on the number of men between the age of 20 and 60 that were conscripted from military service, the entire population had to be a minimum of 3.5 million people. And as many scholars have pointed out, given that only 70 people were residing in the land of Egypt at the time that Joseph reached his peak as the prime minister of the Egyptian Empire, those 70, it's very unlikely they could have multiplied up to 3.5 million people in just four generations. Not impossible, but very unlikely. But what does the text say? That God brought favor upon the Egyptians, or upon the Hebrews, in the eyes of the Egyptians. And when the Exodus came, many Egyptians said, "We want to be joined with you. We know that God is with you. We want to be part of you." And the Jews welcomed them. That's something, by the way, you see in the Hebrew culture. There was always a pathway for a Gentile to become a Hebrew. Now, for a Gentile man, it wasn't a pleasant way. He had to be circumcised. But there was a way for Gentiles to become Jews. And we see in the Exodus is a very large number of Gentiles from throughout the entire Egyptian Empire said, "We want to become part of this Jewish enterprise." And therefore, we had this millions of people leaving the land of Egypt. Now, how did that happen? It's because of the influence of Joseph and his descendants that the news, or the message of salvation and developing a relationship with God, could be communicated to all those people to such a degree. You're first. Yeah, it's not like Charlton Heston.
They have some young kid that they bring in who speaks God, as God, and it's very disappointing from a Christian perspective, but it is entertaining.
Well, that's what I've been told, too, from people who've seen it. The special effects are awesome, but the 10 plagues are kind of portrayed as naturalistic events rather than supernatural. God is portrayed as a teenage boy or even younger, and there's no rejoicing of the Jews when they cross the Red Sea.
They call it as somebody who's a non-believer trying to make money off of the believers.
Yeah, it could be. Mm-hmm. So, if you want to see one that's biblically accurate, the Ten Commandments of... And by the way, I thought they should have gotten Charlton Heston for this new movie. He's finally old enough to play the part. So, yeah.
I'm not going to do a proper job on this. Some are speculating in terms of the size of the population, of the Jewish population, size of the population exited Egypt, that the word used for the population size could mean something much less. And like I said, I'm not doing it justice. But the word could mean this rather than the typical interpretation.
Right, you're right, John. That's in the theological literature where Bible scholars have looked at these texts and say it doesn't have to be interpreted as being 3.5 million people plus.
Maybe 60,000.
Maybe we can interpret it as a lot less than that. Mm-hmm. Here's the difficulty with that approach. They come into the land of Canaan, and the Canaanites say, "This vast horde is going to overwhelm us." Well, the population of Canaan at that time was a little less than 5 million. Why would 5 million look at this group of people coming out of Egypt, numbering only 60,000, and referring to it as a vast horde that's going to overwhelm us? And the fact is, they did conquer Canaan. So that the fact that they conquered Canaan indicated it couldn't be a small number of people. But as I look at this literature, they're all overlooking those texts in Exodus where it says many Egyptians chose to come with them. And what you see after the 10 plagues, God tells the Jews, go to your Egyptian friends and, quote, rob them. Basically, the Jews had such high favor in the eyes of the Egyptians that the Egyptians were very generous in saying, look, you're going to leave, take this, take this. You're going to need this. And so they were able to leave with a vast store of goods as they, quote, plundered the Egyptians. And plunder is really a word you see in the English translation. What you get in the original is that these Egyptians thought so highly of these Jewish people that they just wanted to bless them. And many of them said, look, we not only want to bless you with our material wealth, we want to join you. And a large number must have joined them. And I'm arguing this is in the context of God wanting to bring redemption to all the people groups of the world. Because this is a time when literally you had people from all over the Egyptian Empire. So it wasn't just Jews living in the northern part of the Nile that were joining these Jews. They literally came from every one of the provinces of the Egyptian Empire. And so it kind of gave the Jewish nation a population that was now capable, once they're settled in the land of Canaan, of being able to reach out to all the people groups of the world, because they actually had within their population segments of all the people groups of the known world at that time. Yes.
Another interesting point, if any rational person were to see those 10 plagues, it would convince them that the real God was at work here, and these are his people, and gee, I'd sure like to be attached to those folks. They weren't all hard-headed like the Pharaoh. You know?
They weren't all hard-headed, and even the magicians that were employed by Pharaoh were saying to Pharaoh, this is the hand of the real God. So you know, even his priests of this, quote, satanic religion were saying, these miracles are things we can't do. And by the way, that's something significant there. Satan does perform miracles. But what you see in the book of Exodus with the 10 plagues is that God is performing miracles that Satan and his priests can't do. So it's not making the point that Satan is incapable of performing miracles. He is. But God is more powerful than Satan. And the 10 plagues still today, that's still true today. So yeah, I mean, I've been in witchcraft covens, and I've seen the kinds of miracles that these, quote, followers of Satan can perform. But there's a difference. And when you're in that kind of situation, you can count on the fact God will come through with his miraculous powers. And by the way, when you read 1 Corinthians 12 about those miraculous gifts God bestows upon his people, they're there to break down supernatural barriers to the gospel. So I don't expect to see those kinds of miracles where the barriers are not present. But where they are, God will show that he is more powerful than the evil one. Yes?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have struggled with not finding the archaeological cultural evidence of Jews in Goshen, except for a recent discovery. I think I read about a place called Tel Al-Daba, I think they call it, where they are seeing some Hebrew cultural implements and things. But it seems like the Egyptians pretty well erased the record following the Exodus.
Well, one thing that is clear about that supports what you see in the book of Exodus, the collapse of the Egyptian Empire. When they lost their Jewish slaves, and especially when they lost all these Egyptians going with the Jews, because probably the Egyptians and people in the Egyptian Empire that went with the Jews, they were probably the cream of the crop. And the fact that they had this huge loss of population, huge brain drain, collapsed the Egyptian Empire. And the collapse of the Egyptian Empire as the Jews went into the land of Canaan is well documented. Now, the reason why you don't see a lot of written evidence of that in the Egyptian records is they don't record the bad things. And so, yeah, if you look at the Egyptian records, there's no record of a collapse of the Egyptian Empire.
Yeah, there's no reason given, but there's evidence
that it did. Yeah, there's clear evidence that the Egyptian Empire collapsed. And the collapse of the Egyptian Empire actually worked to the advantage of fulfilling the message of taking God's offer of redemption to all the people groups of the world. It decentralized the Egyptian Empire. And so this is where you see the rise of new empires following the collapse of the Egyptian Empire. And now we've got the Jews back at the nexus of three great continents. The land of Canaan is where Europe and Asia and Africa come together. And so the empires and the nations in Africa, as they communicate and trade with those in Europe and Asia and vice versa, have to come into contact with God's people. And part of God's people are actually people from all these nations. And so you'll find people being able to speak the native language, for example, because that's what you see in the flood account. We have all these different languages. So it's crucial that God equip these people living in the land of Canaan with the ability to communicate to these people with different languages. But that was the wonderful thing about the Exodus, is now the Jewish population had within it native speakers of all these different nations around them. And so God could use that to communicate. And notice, too, what Moses says. I don't know whether this gets into the movie or not. It did get into the one back in the 1950s, the Ten Commandments. But you see this in Exodus. Now that they've left the land of Egypt, they're in Sinai. And what does Moses say to him? God is going to bless you with righteous laws, so that all the nations around you will hear how righteous your laws are, how wise your leaders are, and they'll be attracted to come to you. And that's going to be your opportunity to communicate with them the message of redemption. You're next.
So did these Egyptians that traveled with them convert to Judaism, or did they continue?
They converted to Judaism because that's the only way they would have been accepted by the Hebrew people. And so, I mean, you kind of see that throughout the whole of the Old Testament. Gentiles are referred to as dogs. They're referred to as godless people. And the only way a Gentile would be accepted within the Jewish national culture is if they became Jews, which meant they had to become followers of Yahweh. The men had to be circumcised. The children, the male children had to be circumcised. They had to be participating in the worship practices. They had to submit to the priesthood. So yeah, it was a big deal for a Gentile Egyptian to become a Jew. And so it wasn't just people who say, hey, we're going to go with you, but we're going to continue practicing our religions. Although probably there was some syncretization where people did kind of both. I mean, it's quite likely that was going on. Yeah, Steve.
It's really hard for me to conceive of a number of people that represents a substantial fraction comparable to the entire population of Los Angeles Basin emigrating away from some place with low technology for obvious things like just being able to communicate among each other. You know, we're taking off today, we're camping here, we're going to stay for a while. These instructions based on one or two people or a small core of leadership. I know that as far as handling disputes, when this process is well underway, they came up with the process of having leaders,
right,
leaders take care of things. But just the food distribution, the acquisition of food, here's where we're going to camp, here's where we're taking off, normal communication things as well as a host of other things, I can't conceive how that large number could possibly pull together.
Well, here's what you'll see in the theological literature. You've got critics of the biblical text saying, if the population was that high, then there's going to be significant archaeological remains and we don't find them. But what you also see in the text is that God fed them with manna. And notice what happens to the manna. If they don't eat it, it disappears. So basically, what the text tells us is you're not going to expect any evidence of archaeological remains because they're not living in cities or towns. They're living in tents, and they take their tents with them. And so you see detailed instruction in the latter half of the book of Exodus for this nomadic culture that they're going to be practicing while God gives them the law. And as I first read this at age 17, I said, this explains why there's no archaeological remains. The text is telling us that this is how God was taking care of them. He was providing them with water. He was providing them with the manna. But there isn't going to be any significant remains. Although one thing I thought of at age 17, all the instruction of what you do with your excrement, maybe we dig around Sinai, we might find some mineral indication of that. That's probably the one thing we might be able to recover. But other than that, I wouldn't expect to find anything. But the bottom line is the population had to be large. Otherwise, they would not have been able to conquer Canaan. So the sheer capacity of them conquering Canaan and the reaction of the people around there as they began to approach the land of Canaan tells us this had to indeed be a vast horde. And likewise, what would explain the collapse of the Egyptian Empire? If they only lost 100,000 people, the Egyptian Empire should have been fine. But no, it suffered a catastrophic collapse. Okay, I think you're next, then you, then I'll come back. Yeah, go ahead.
Notice that even their sandals didn't wear out, so they wouldn't have left.
They wouldn't have left any sandals, right?
But I do have a question. Where I'm looking for exactly where it says that a large number of Egyptians went with them.
The best
match I can find is Exodus 12:38.
Yeah, that might be it. I got it underlined in my Bible. Let me see if you're right on that one.
But it's...
it's just a single sentence, but it's a significant sentence.
Exodus 12:38.
Yeah, many other people went up with them, as well as large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. So yeah, it's you got it. Chapter 12, 37 and 38. So, yeah, which is why you don't see a lot of discussion on this in the theological literature, because all you got is a single sentence that would indicate that there was a lot of people who were not blood relatives or blood descendants of Abraham that had joined in with them. And so the fact that you just got that one obscure reference explains why people think they all had to be blood relatives. But that would indicate they weren't all blood relatives. And moreover, how do you explain the events that happen once they get into the land of Canaan? 60,000 people are not going to be able to overwhelm 5 million Canaanites. Yes.
40 years in the desert. How much did the population increase?
Well, the text actually tells us, because as you go through the Torah, it actually names the number of men ready for battle between the age of 20 and 60 at the beginning of the Exodus, and the number at the end of the Exodus. And you can look at those numbers; they're roughly the same. So what it tells us is that the population was roughly comparable throughout those 40 years that they were wandering in the wilderness. Because that's what God said, because of your rebellion, none of you except Joshua and Caleb are going to enter into the promised land. So he says you're all going to die off. Now, given their nomadic lifestyle, it'd be difficult for the population to increase in any significant way. But, you know, what's speculative, we don't know how many women and children were also part of the population. But roughly comparable, yes.
Wasn't Joseph's wife Egyptian?
Joseph's wife was an Egyptian.
And who knows, maybe others took spouses who converted.
Well, Moses likewise had a wife that was not an Egyptian. And what it tells us about Moses' wife was a different race.
Yes.
Her skin color was different than his. And so this actually gives you some indication that the Gentiles that joined with the Jews literally did come from all the different parts of the Egyptian Empire, because of the fact that there's actual racial diversity. And by the way, you actually see this in the bloodline of Jews to this very day. Significant racial diversity. Yes.
The fall, downfall of the Egyptian Empire. Time frame for that, and does that coincide with any pharaoh who lost his firstborn?
Well, that's debated. So there's considerable debate about when the Exodus took place, and which pharaoh is the one that's actually mentioned here in the text. There's, you know, some people said maybe it's Ramses II. A lot of scholars disagree with that, say it can't be Ramses II. It has to be an earlier pharaoh. I personally lean towards a date in the 15th century B.C. because this would be consistent with Hebrew going from a verbal language to a written language. That happened in the 15th century A.D. and it just seems to make sense to me. This would be a good means to, you know, in terms of what God is doing. Finally, we get Hebrew as a written language. That's going to be an additional tool to communicate to all the people groups the message of God's offer of redemption. And that would really help all these different people groups that are with the Jews at that time. Not just an oral message, but now a written message.
Okay, the downfall?
The downfall of the Egyptian Empire, that too is debated. Okay, now the numbers are about plus or minus 150 years, if you want to know what the error bar is. So yeah, I mean, there are people who say 12th century BC, others that say 15th and 14th century. I personally favor the earlier date, mainly based on, you know, if God is really trying to use all these political events as a tool for redemption, the 15th century makes the most sense. But it's not proven. Let's see. Ted, you were next.
I was just going to make the same comment about the sandals. I think the same thing would go with their carts.
Right.
Their implements, all their stuff. And their legs didn't swell up. So he just killed them for their rebellion. And I don't know what he did with their bodies. Those did deteriorate. He probably got God angry and didn't want any record of them.
Well, your human bodies do deteriorate very quickly. So, I mean, that's one reason why I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between being buried and being cremated. Within 100 years, you got the same result. I mean, literally, that's how quickly human bodies will decay, including the bones. The bones will decay quickly. Unless you do what the Egyptians did and embalm their pharaohs, where they spend literally a year preparing the body so that the flesh and bones don't decay. But unless you're very wealthy, and by the way, Pharaoh suffered the same fate as the rest of us, so you wouldn't expect there to be bones lying in Sinai. And you're right, it says the clothes did not wear out. So they were basically taking everything they started with and took it all the way through those 40 years, which means you're not going to see a lot of sandals or clothing or personal goods lying around. They basically took everything and they had and it all got preserved or remains of food. The manna disappeared within hours after it was delivered. You were next.
Well, you know, when you talk about them wandering in the desert, isn't there a defined area that they wandered for 40 years? And also, what were what were the practices they had for their dead? How did they bury them? You talk about destruction of the body. Wouldn't possibly some of the cultural practices from the Egyptians, the mummification of the body, and preserving them and burying them? We've got 3 million plus people. Who's watching to see how are they burying the people? So therefore, why not? Why didn't they find? I would think that goes against the fact that there were this many people, I would think that they would find evidence if indeed there were that many people wandering in a defined area.
Well, I mean, we do see Joseph saying on his deathbed, preserve my bones and take my bones into the land of Canaan, because he basically gave a prophecy. God will deliver you from this land and bring you back to the land of Canaan when he does take my bones with you. So they would have taken care to preserve his bones. And once they got into the land of Canaan, they buried his bones. Once they buried the bones quickly decayed. The people who were blood descendants of Abraham probably were burying their dead, which means they would quickly decay. And you're speculating that maybe some of the Egyptians that joined in with them would have carried on the practice of embalming. Well, what we notice in the Egyptian historical records, the only people that got embalmed were members of the royal family. Everybody else didn't have that privilege. And by the way, that embalming required significant investment and technology, which meant you needed a stable population, large population, wealthy population, living in one place. If you got these 3.5 million people nomadically wandering through the area of Sinai, that's basically going to put an end to any embalming practice. They simply won't have the means to pull that off. And by the way, we have no record any members of the line of Pharaoh joined with the Egyptians. So, again, I would expect there to be no remains, even if the population was, say, upwards towards 4 million people.
No more questions here.
No more questions? That's right, we're out of time.
I do have one correction, though, with royalty and cap. The cap person, I have to let you know that we didn't bomb the cap. I said, we didn't look at cap. Royalty and cap.
Royalty and cap.
Just to be clear.
Just to be really clear.
We were satanically based in the religious.
Close us in prayer. Have a wonderful New Year.
Well,
see you on the floor.
We're not going to be embalming our cats, I can tell you that. It's not going to happen. Even though we think our cats are great, so okay.
They think there should be a bomb. They think they're in charge.
Yeah, that's what they say is the difference between a dog and a cat that's bonded to you. The dog will treat you as if you are God. The cat thinks he is God. So okay, where I'm going with all of this is how God works to bring the message of redemption to all the people, groups of the world. And we're beginning with, God starting with Joseph. And then we go to, well, actually it starts with Abraham, Joseph, Moses. And then once they're in the land, we have the rising of the empire of David and Solomon and the impact that has. And then afterwards, it reverts back to the Joseph model. What's the Joseph model? Having the Jews and their defeat become slaves, and as slaves they begin to impact the whole world. And so, for example, I can name you a number of slaves. We got Joseph as a slave. We have Daniel as a slave. We got Mordecai as a slave. Moses was in that category. And in each case, they rose to become the equivalent of the prime minister of the dominant world empire upon the planet. And then as we move into the era of Jesus, what does he do with the Jews? He changes their livelihood from being rural, agricultural type people. That's what was going on during the kingdom of Solomon and David, is that the Jewish nation became very productive in their capacity to raise food and began to trade with all the people groups with their food. But the time that Jesus of Nazareth came, the Jewish activity changed from a rural enterprise to an urban enterprise. And what we see in the diaspora is God sending influential Jews to live in all the large cities that existed around the world. And so as we get into the book of Acts, we're going to see how God used these Jewish populations in large cities and Roman peace and the Roman road system to change the strategy of taking the good news of salvation to all the people and groups of the world. And by the way, one of you asked me last week, is it really the case that in the Old Testament, God equipped his people to take the message of salvation to all the people and groups of the world? Read the book of Job. In the book of Job, you see two men, Job and Elihu, who are declaring God's plan of redemption and salvation. Not with biblical texts, but with texts from the book of nature. And so, yeah, they were equipped even before biblical texts existed, and they're active in doing that. When you look carefully at the book of Job, you'll see how Job and Elihu were preaching the gospel to skeptics. Now, God, as we go through the Bible, we see that God equips his people with more and more tools to communicate his message of redemption. You get the basic tool in the book of Job, but with every succeeding book of the Bible, God expands the toolkit for taking the message of salvation. And today, the toolkit has never been bigger. We live at a time when the toolkit is the biggest it's ever been. With that, let me close. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for giving all of us here the privilege of being alive in the 21st century. We're a toolkit for taking your message of redemption to all the people groups of the world has never been bigger and never more efficient and never more greatly endowed. Father, I pray that you would use each of us in remaining days of this year and the first days of 2015 to be sensitive to opportunities that you give us to be an ambassador of reconciliation. We can encourage people who don't yet know you to make their peace with God and to receive your redemptive offer. In Jesus' name, amen.